welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, it's Norman Swan here with the Health Report. On this program, another chance to hear an extraordinary story and perhaps a fundamental lesson for doctors and medical researchers who, according to the person you're about to hear, are dangerously undertrained in decision-making and people suffer as a result, sometimes fatally. Professor Stephen Schneider of Stanford University in California was once a plasma physicist, but for most of his career has been at the forefront of climate research and has pioneered the concept of global warming. A few years ago, Stephen Schneider was diagnosed with cancer and now calls himself the patient from hell. In fact, he's written a book with that title, which is about his experience of dealing with his doctors and forcing them to confront how they think.
In climate change, we never have certain answers. We know that we're going to warm up. We know we've already done that. We know we're going to warm up somewhere from another degree if we're incredibly lucky, up to more than five if we're incredibly unlucky. So I'm always advising people on precautionary principles. You know, if it's only 1% chance your house will burn down and almost everybody has fire insurance, and we're looking at 50% chances of serious outcomes. Well, I had a cancer. I had an 80% chance that after my treatments were over, I was going to get it back. And I said, I'm not going to sit around and do nothing. We're going to use the same principles you use in climate policy and treat it as if I was going to get it back. And I was told, well, we don't do that. And I said, well, we're going to do that. And it was a very interesting conversation getting there. And eventually we did. And we're still all friends.
Tell me the first day that you noticed something wrong.
Well, the first day I noticed something wrong was when I was in the climate business again, about to head over to Geneva for a very confrontational meeting with 100 governments about approving a climate report. So I'm in the shower and I notice this puffiness under my right arm and I kind of blew it off. Then I noticed there was this black and blue stain on my arm and I said, oh no, I might have a phlebitis. I can't tell my wife. She'll tell me I can't go. And she's going. She's on the podium with
She's a scientist in climate change as well.
She's a scientist in climate change. And we'd been working for 3 years. I'm not going to miss this show. This is important. But I knew that I couldn't lie to her, so I called my doc, and he went over everything. No, it's not phlebitis. Come see me when you get back.
And you have to say that the institution that you work has one of the world's best medical schools in it.
Yeah, Stanford University Hospitals, arguably in the top 10 in most departments. So I go back and see my internist, who was also the head of internal medicine, and he says, I don't know what it is, so let's just do some precautionary blood tests. We did the blood tests. Everything was fine. Went off on a month's trip. In fact, I came to Australia. Went back. It was still there. This time they did ultrasounds. They did x-rays. Nothing. Now we're off to the Galapagos. And when I get back, I knew he wasn't going to say do another test. It's now 3 months. The lump's still there. We go into the...
And you're feeling well all
the time. I'm feeling fine. I'm feeling absolutely my normal lunatic self. I have to fight with all the deniers of climate change and with...
You're a giant slayer.
No, I'm a giant dealer. I'm more like Don Quixote than I am David. You know, David won. I'm out there getting windmill wounds. But anyhow, so there we are and we go in and see them and they're feeling around... And they're going to take it. I said, no, 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 that's not the one. It's in another part. He says, no, I'm feeling the big one. And I look over at Terry, and she looks back at me, and we say, this is not going to be good. And we had a meeting in Baltimore, and I'm sitting in the airport, and there's about 6 minutes to go before the door of the airplane closes. I just call my office. And my secretary says, oh, Dr. Jacobs called. I said, okay, I'll call him later. No, he told you to call him now. And I said, oh, really? He gave me his private number.
The blood is draining from
your
face.
The blood is draining. As I said, the butterflies in my stomach started to flutter. And he answered the phone, and he said, where are you? I said, I'm in the airport, and the door closes in 2 minutes. He said, be on that plane. Be here tomorrow. I said, what, Michael? He said, lymphoma. Don't worry, we have the best medicine in the world. We'll figure it out. And by then, the butterflies had lifted me off the seat, and I got through the door before it closed. Terry takes one look at me. And
I'm presuming you're in a trance at this point.
Yeah, it was an out-of-body experience. I don't know what lymphoma, all I know is it sounds very bad. And she said, what? So I said, well, he said it's a non-Hodgkin's B-cell lymphoma. Be glad it's not T-cell. We're going to fix it. And she just looks at me and she grabs my hand and she says, we'll solve this together.
So you go back. The diagnosis is confirmed. What are you told about the disease that you've got? Because it's not a straightforward non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that
you've
got.
Well, we go to see the new doc that my internist set up. And again, You know, I'm a professor at Stanford, so I'm pretty lucky. I got to the top rank, and one of the reasons I wrote The Patient from Hell is I want other people to know how to do this. You know, they're all not in my position, and you just can't have medicine for the elite. That's not all right. But I'm not an idiot. I'm going to take it when I'm sure. given it. So she says, actually it was her fellow, says, "You have," in his grave voice, "mantle cell lymphoma." And Terry said the blood drained out of her. By this time, I'm in such a detached state, I don't know, I'm not even listening to people. And she says, "Well, you said that so ominously. Why?" "Well, it's only a 4% incidence of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma."
And so he had a funereal voice on.
Yes,
when he said
funereal
it.
Voice. And finally, the main doc, Sandra Horning, walked in. First thing she said is, "I presume that you people do research and you work on the web." "Yes." "Don't go to the web and look it up. You'll just be depressed. All our treatments are new. They're not on the web yet. It's much better than what you're going to read."
What would you have read?
That I had a 2-year life expectancy if I was lucky. They had new treatments, but there was no real data on how effective they were. So I said I wanted to know everything, and she then looked me sternly and said, "You really want to know everything?" And I said, "Hey, look, I'm in the climate change business. You know, we have to deal with the health of the world. This is me, but I still want to know everything." So she proceeded for the next 15 minutes to explain everything, and I had the weirdest experience I'd ever had in my life. It reminded me of seeing that movie, the Spielberg movie, Saving Private Ryan, where when they land at Omaha Beach, all of a sudden all this blood and guts and machine gunning goes at about a quarter speed, as if it was in a trance, the slow motion. It was like an out-of-body experience.
And you're taking in nothing.
And I'm right, and I'm a left-brained person. I'm saying, "No, this is your life. You have to hear every word." And that's the last time that actually happened. All the other times I was there, but it was really very strange. And it makes me sympathetic to people who can't live with these diagnoses. They're so shocking.
But you started to seriously question how doctors think.
Well, what happened is I started going through the procedures. And the first day of chemo, I go to see the fellow, and they
You should say the fellow is like a senior registrar.
Yeah. He says, "Go up and do the chemos, and you come back in 10 days for a blood test." And the chemos are 3 weeks apart. The last thing I wanted was another stick. I said, "How many times are they going to ghoul me?" And he explained why this was important, because they wanted to find out my nadir. So I said, "What's my nadir?" You know, not the guy who ran for president and gave us Bush.
Your nadir,
no,
as they
not
would
that
say.
One. This is a low point. And
in your white blood cell count.
In your white blood cell count, which is critical because that tells you you're immunocompromised. It's good news because I had a white blood cell cancer. So the lower we get it, the more they're knocking the cancer out. But the lower my white cells go, the more I could die of a common cold. So I asked him to draw for me in the air what it was like. So he drew this
pattern of
blood. Yeah, curve. The first week, my white count was going to go way down. Then it was going to bottom out in the second week and then return. And I said, "Well, does the cancer return in the third week?" "Yes, that's why we give you another chemo 3 weeks later." I said, "So the nadir really matters." I said, "It looks like a parabola this middle week, you know, a little curved surface." "Yeah." I said, "Well, you know, a parabola takes 3 points to define it." And here I was trying to get out of the blood test. Now I want them to give me 3 blood tests because we couldn't define the minima. And he looked like, "Who is this guy?" And I said, "Well, you told me it's really important. So let's find what the minimum is. Are you sure that every patient reaches the minimum 10 days after the first treatment? Isn't there some variability from patient to patient?" My left brain was back in gear. And he said, "Well, some doctors don't do it at all." I said, "I'm not interested in the practice of people who don't understand mathematics. Why don't we do 3? "Well, that's not how we do it. End of story."
And you fiddled the system, so you got 3.
So I said, no, this is important. I'm convinced. This guy knows his cancer, but he doesn't know his mathematics. So what I did is I found out that there were 3 nurses who could authorize these tests. So I went to the second one and said that, though, Dr. Horning said that I need a blood test for my nadir, and told me to do it on a date, which I happened to have picked 3 days before this one. And then I went to the third nurse, said, "Dr. Horning said I need a test," which I picked 3 days after. So when the first test was in, the nurse who arranged that called up and told me that my counts were going down nicely, but not anywhere near danger. Everything's fine. But that wasn't the one they ordered. That was one of my phony points. So now the one that they ordered, the 10 days later, comes in, and I was pretty low, but I wasn't at the threshold that they would consider dangerous. Monday, I'm in the office. The phone rings. It's nurse 3. "Dr. Schneider." "Yes." "You're in your office?" "Yes." that's not a safe place for you to be. I said, well, I wasn't told your result is so low, you should be in the hospital, you should be in the clean room. And
so your nadir happened 3 days after.
3 days afterward, one of my three tests. Oh, I, by the way, didn't go to the hospital. I said, hospital, that's where the germs are. You call up Dr. Horning and tell her I'll go home.
I mean, this is one of the recurrent themes in your book, which is you talk about how medicine talks about the average patient. And on the law of averages, in this one, they'd have missed your nadir and you would have been in a dangerous circumstance without knowing it.
That's right. And as a climate scientist, Norman, it's exactly the same thing. You can't talk about the average hurricane. You have to talk about the Category 5s that would level Cairns or that took out New Orleans. So it's the serious events that you have to work against. And you never know whether you're what I call the mythical median or the mythical average patient, or whether you're one of the lucky ones or whether you're one of the unlucky ones. And that's why I keep arguing you must individualize diagnostics.
But
and
you
treatments.
Also, but in fact, you also argue really on the precautionary principle that you assume that you're a Category 5 hurricane. That's the safe position to be in.
Well, the safe position by analogy is they should have had the levees and the dikes in New Orleans designed for Category 5. They were barely capable for Category 3, and one eventually took out the city. This was a self-inflicted wound.
And your argument is that the medical system is operating on a similar principle.
It's operating on a principle of average treatment. So what I'm doing is I'm asking that they do individualized treatment.
So by the application of basic maths, Steve saved himself from potentially serious complications. This is the Health Report here on ABC Radio National, and you're listening to climatologist Professor Steve Schneider from Stanford University in California, talking about why he's the patient from hell. Let's stay with him on this journey where each step of the way he challenged his physicians about the decisions they were making based on averages rather than individuals.
When I went in for my second chemo, the nurses tried to send me home, telling me my white count was too low and it wasn't safe to give me the chemos. And I said, but Dr. Horning told me that it was really critical not to lose even a week because the cancer is growing back. And then Terry added, because she'd been studying the web, well, why don't you give him this stem cell stimulant, Neupogen, and then he could have both. They didn't know what to do, so they said, you have to go home. I said, I'm not getting out of this chair. You're not taking out this IV until Dr. Horning tells me I shouldn't be getting it. Half an hour later, up comes the fellow. We've decided to give you Neupogen. You stay and get it. She wants you to be treated. She doesn't want you to go home. And so, listen, the major doc backed me up on pretty much every one of these, but I had to go through stuff to get there.
And the point, again, being that if you weren't a pain in the ass, so to speak, you would have gone home.
Right. It got even worse. I said to him, and they'd given me IV Benadryl, and I'm in this stupor. It felt like I had a chainmail suit on. You know, I'm dragged down, but my left brain is powerful enough when it's my life that I can cut through the drug-induced stupor. And I said, why didn't I get it in the first place? And he said, oh, well, because you have to earn it. And I said, what do you
this
mean?
This is the Neupogen you're
the
talking
Neupogen, about. The Neupogen, the stem cell stimulant that would have had me at no risk of immunocompromise. And I wouldn't have had to go home for a week, which cost Stanford arguably thousands of dollars in lost wages. And I said, what do you mean earn it? And he said, well, only 20% of people go below the danger line. And I said, well, maybe if you gave them three blood tests, you'd find out that 40 or 50% do. And he said, well, it's only cost-benefit analysis. I said, wait a minute, I teach cost-benefit analysis. And cost-benefit analysis is not just about the cost to private institutions. The benefits are also social benefits. What did it cost Stanford? How much are these shots? Maybe $500. I said, so we cost Stanford $3,000 in losses to me, but this institution doesn't want to pay $500, and you put me at risk of pneumonia. Your system has to change. At that moment, I said, I'm going to write the patient from hell. I was mad enough that I was going to do it. And it wasn't the docs. It was the system. And what I get angry at docs is fight the system more is my advice. The courageous ones are going to have to do it.
So you had multiple courses of chemotherapy. You had the latest monoclonal antibody drug for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, rituximab. And things weren't working out.
Well, actually, things were working out. My cancer went to non-detectable in a CAT scan, which they call complete remission, in only four treatments. So, of course, I asked the question. I said, well, how do you know? And they said, well, the CAT scan is clear. And I said, well, that's not enough. So he said, well, we're taking a bone marrow biopsy and we'll see that. I don't recommend those for, you know, routine amusement. And they looked at the fluid in the bone marrow. And the next time I came in, they came in and congratulated me again. The bone marrow biopsy shows zero. So you're in absolute complete remission. And I said, well, how do they do the bone marrow biopsy? He said, what do you mean? I said, isn't there a human being looking through a microscope at the number of cells? Yeah. I said, how many cells in a drop of bone marrow fluid? Oh, a million. Now, how many cells can this human being see in the 5 minutes that they're looking at? Maybe 1,000. So how do you know there weren't a few cells left? Well, there could be. It's called MRD, minimum residual disease. And I said, but cancer clones, if there's only one, couldn't it grow back? Don't we have to presume it's there? CAT scan's not good enough. Bone marrow's not good enough. Let's just treat it prophylactically after the fact. And he said, well, Sandra has already said that she wants you to do two more chemos just for that reason. After then, you're going to do your bone marrow transplant just for that reason. So it sounded very reasonable. They were being very precautionary. But the battle began because I said, now, after the bone marrow transplant, what are we going to do? And they said, monitor it. And I, whoa, you know, if you monitor the Greenland ice sheet for melting, by the time it starts melting and it's detectable, it's probably too late to stop it from slipping into the sea. So I'm thinking, no, wait a minute here.
Their thinking is, we're going to beat your bone marrow into a pulp and assume that we've cured you.
You're in complete remission. It's all we do. And I challenged that the tools that they were using for complete remission were insufficient. I said, you're using a large-scale macro test. I want a micro test. I want you to do what's called PCR, which stands for looking for an individual strand of DNA, and the strand I wanted them to look for was my particular brand of cancer. Why did I know about this? Because I'm a professor in a biology department. Enough is rubbed off, so I wanted the state of the art applied to detecting my individual cancer. And they said, we simply don't do that except experimentally. I said, make me an experiment. So we had a little debate about that. 6 months later, they did.
Were they getting angry with you?
I don't think so. I am not an anti-doctor person. They are trying to help you. They're stuck in a system that's not so great.
But they can get you hear from patients, from consumers, and we've all had the experience, when you actually challenge a doctor and say, what's the evidence for this? The good doctors will respond, but doctors who are maybe just a bit under par and don't know the evidence can act very defensively and get very angry with their patients.
Then my advice to the patient, if they possibly can, is try somebody else.
But you didn't experience that with your
doctors? No, I did not experience it. We got arguments, and we don't do it that way.
But
some of the arguments
were valid. It was an adult-to-adult conversation.
Yeah, that's right, Norman. Some of the arguments were valid, and we said, well, we had a dumb idea here. Just tell us why it isn't that. But we would come in with new studies. And I said, so here's what this new latest study shows. Why aren't we doing that? And Sandra said, let me think about it. The next time we were there, they bought a new machine based on the downloads we gave that purges blood better than what they were doing before. So they were open-minded. They are, after all, a world-leading institution. And the patients may be doing some of the web research that they would learn anyway in the meeting 6 months or a year from now.
Because it was your life.
Yeah, they were listening in my life. And I was in a situation where I didn't have any extra time.
So when they did the PCR after the bone marrow
transplant? They did it after the bone marrow transplant, and it was negative. And they said, we don't know how to interpret it. And I said, well, if it's growing, it means I'm getting my cancer back.
And how are you feeling at this point? Because a bone marrow transplant is a hell of a thing to go through physically.
It took a couple of years to really get back to full strength. Though I was out traveling and back in the climate wars within 6 months, maybe I pushed it a little too hard.
But also the implication is, by assuming that you're a Category 5 hurricane, you put yourself in the cancer situation through pretty horrendous treatments.
Yes, and I knew they had lasting side effects.
With a significant mortality rate.
I could have induced, and I still face this possibility, there's about a 5% chance that we've induced a leukemia from this treatment. But the story wasn't over, because one day I decided to do what I do in climate science, which is what we call decision analysis. Don't ask them what to do. Don't ask them what can happen. But ask them a series of questions that you would ask an expert when there was uncertainty, like what's going to happen in the climate future. So I said, okay, Sandra, there are 100 patients like me with mantle cell lymphoma, which is a very hard to get rid of disease. They're in complete remission, just like me. They got through their bone marrow transplant. There's no sign in a CAT scan or even, at the moment, the molecular test. In 5 years, how many of them are still going to be in complete remission? And she said, well, you know, I can't really know. We don't have clinical trials. I said, I know, but I trust my life to your intuition about cancer. You're a world-class doctor. I didn't tell her that in the other side of my head, I said, I don't trust anything to your decision analysis skills because you don't have any. That's my job. Cancer's your job. Decisions are my job. Let's do this together.
But decision analysis skills should actually be the job of a senior doctor.
Well, I've been going to medical schools trying to talk them into making that part of the curriculum. So she told me, 80. And I said, now of the 80, if they had 100 patients who lost remission, and it sounds like the vast majority would, how many could you get back? And she said, maybe 50. So I said, so I have a 40% chance that in the next 5 years, I'm a dead man, right? 80% chance I get it back. Only 50% chance you can fix it. Supposing you took 100 people off the street and you gave them prophylactic treatment, a maintenance therapy with a relatively low impacting drug. This is the monoclonal antibody, or rituximab. How many would still be there at the end of 5 years? She said, we'd never do that. We don't give people off the street dangerous drugs. I said, no, no, no. We got to play the game fair. How many would you kill? And she said, well, if it was done properly in a hospital, the only real threat is probably from an allergic reaction. We could take care of that. I said, so let me just say one. So now, how many microseconds do we have to think to realize that 1% versus 40% means we need maintenance therapy? You have to treat me just like John Rawls, the social philosopher, says. He calls it a veil of ignorance. And when you ask somebody, well, should we have social policy to deal with health for the poor and so forth? If you ask people who are already doing very well, then the likelihood that they're going to advocate policy for somebody else is much less than if you go to a poor person and you say, should we have social policy for the poor? So Rawls's brilliant concept was a veil of ignorance. Supposing we didn't know whether we were going to be rich or poor, and you ask somebody what's their view on social policy, it's going to be a lot higher likelihood that they're going to want to hedge because they might be in the box.
It could be you one day.
I said, hey, I don't know whether I'm one of the lucky 20% or the unlucky 80%, so we have to, in a veil of ignorance, treat me with maintenance therapy. Took 2 years, and it took my PCR, my molecular test, going positive before we finally talked them into it. And right after we did it, it went back to zero. And the very same fellow who had been so obstreperous about how we were crazy to do this because there's no data came in and said, I don't know how you guys knew. And I said, we just used the information that you gave us, but we did decision analysis.
Has that changed the way they practice?
I believe at Stanford, they are looking more broadly at individualized treatment.
But in fact, it's not individualized treatment. You've just shifted the average, haven't you? I mean, if you're saying you get through the bone marrow, then you need maintenance therapy because of decision analysis that the risk is so low, why wouldn't you do it anyway? Even if you don't know, the likelihood is you're going to be able to suppress it. And we're going to give everybody Neupogen. In fact, what you're doing is you're not individualizing therapy. You're actually changing the average. You're putting the median up there towards category five, aren't you?
That's true. I'm trying to improve that. Where I try to convince them to do individualization is on giving everybody a molecular test. And I guess now that I think about it, to be fair to your challenge, I don't think they're doing that molecular test with very many other people. So maybe I have only changed the average. But what I'm hoping is that those doctors then write this up, so that it is no longer a radical position. Because one of the comments the fellow made to me when I told him he should write me up, he said, I'd be laughed out of the medical profession. You're an N of one. An N of one means a single statistic. You can't do statistics by flipping a coin once and tell if it's loaded. And I said, well, I guess we're pretty stupid in the geophysical sciences. We got only one patient, Ma Earth. How come we know anything? You know? What we do is we don't do clinical trials. What we do is we study...
We've only got one planet.
Yeah, we study every variable, all the temperatures, all the rainfall. We study all the radiation, the carbon dioxide. What we do is construct a process model and how the system works, and we validate the process model. We don't have any possibility of validating the future until the future happens. You have no data on the future. Well, they didn't have any data on my rare cancer. I said, but you have a lot of data. And they said, what kind of data? we know we don't have any data. I said, yes, you do. Did it work in the Petri dish, right, in the lab? Yeah. Does it work in patients with advanced cancer? Yeah. I said, do you think the drug is going on vacation for somebody with minimal residual disease getting a low dose? And then I did it again. There are 100 patients like me. If you gave this prophylactic treatment to them, how many are going to have more cancer cells? And they said, only a few. Why? Because it doesn't work in everybody. I said, how many do you think will have fewer? They said, most of them. I said, what are we talking about? My life is in your hands. Let's just make the right decision. And they did.
But the mantra in medical science, where people who really want to do the right thing, is the randomized controlled trial, where they're constantly testing new regimes against the existing regimes, trying to improve incrementally cancer care. And many people would argue that the system would go broke if, in fact, you took your approach, that, in fact, you've just got to be able to prove that what you're doing is better than existing therapy and you've got to wait for the final results.
I agree that we need data. I wish that the Martians existed and they could have such knowledge of climate that they could come down and tell us which of our computer models were right so that we could forecast the future without having to wait for it to happen. I wish that the Martians knew exactly what each drug would do for each cancer and took mercy on us and came down and told us what it was. Of course, they don't exist. That's what a clinical trial is. But then I asked my doctors this. Supposing this benevolent set of extraterrestrials who knows cancer comes and they tell you the average remission length for every cancer, for every drug, what are you going to do? And they said, well, we're going to give the drug that works best. And of course, I said, best for whom? And they said, best for the patients. And I said, which patients? And now they look confused. The patients with cancer. I said, well, you're only getting the median. You're only getting the average. You're not finding out whether an individual patient actually has less than the average seriousness and you're overdrugging them, or more than the average seriousness and you're underdrugging them. You've got to individualize your tests. You've got to do the molecular test. You have to do individualized diagnostics. You have to adjust your doses to fit that. It's using data, but it's using the data of the response of the patient's system to each individual treatment from which you construct the process model of how their body works. That is absolutely equivalent data to doing clinical trials. Clinical trials are what we call frequency statistics, so lots and lots of numbers. And what I'm talking about in the statistical world is called Bayesian or subjective probabilistic analysis, where you use all the information you have, not just the clinical trial. I want clinical trials, but what do you do for the 15 years with the patients who have this disease? My view is you do better than hang around and do nothing. And I was able to convince my doctors to that, and I'm hoping the patient from hell is convincing other doctors.
So does every team of doctors need a plasma physicist or a Bayesian mathematician at their side?
Well, I don't think that would work too well, since the average person doesn't know too many of those. I think what they need is good patient advocates, somebody who can intervene and help you, because it is nothing more challenging than to sit there with a dread disease. You're already in a state of disconnection. Now you have to look this person in the face who's probably going to save your life, even if not as well as they could, and tell them, sorry, you don't know what you're doing, or what you're doing is not good enough. I mean, that's not something the average person can do. I am trained in intellectual combat. The average person is not. Therefore, they need an advocate. And the advocate has to know enough about medicine to be paid attention to by the doctors.
Except that money does rule.
I think the system has to recognize there, but for fortune go you and I. That veil of ignorance. We can't sit there and say, until we meet the paradigm of medicine, which is a large-scale clinical trial over 10 years giving average results, we're not going to do any experimental treatment. We're not going to individualize diagnostics and testing. I think that's not giving optimal care. I think that's giving substandard care. And I know that I'm talking about elitist medicine. However, that will trickle down.
And not just in cancer care either.
And not just in cancer care. It'll move over into hospitals overseas, and eventually the treatment will go out.
Professor Stephen Schneider of Stanford University in California, who last year was in Adelaide as their thinker in residence. His book is called The Patient from Hell, as you no doubt have already gathered, and it's by Stephen Schneider with the assistance of Jenica Lane, and it's published by DeCapo Press. Me, I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. all the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.